somewhat reluctant to introduce our next guest because he's reputation for terrible jokes. But he is also our host and the director of the observatory here, and a man who I delight in listening to because he has a never-ending supply of stories, as you all know if you read his column in Sky and Telescope. So, Ed.
Think I would know how to operate this room. That I have to conduct. Forgive me. First, I'd like to leave some light on because I'll need to see notes. Obviously, on behalf of Griffith Observatory, City of Los Angeles, Department of Recreation and Parks, this is my chance to welcome you from all of those institutions. It is a delight, in fact, to have you here. In addition to that, I want you to know that the observatory staff, high-level staff, has been working its tail and actually reasonably successful. But we are still in the period, not only of shakedown, but of subcontractor systems fixing. And in fact, the difficulties that we experienced this morning were exactly related to that. But the staff has managed to figure out some patches. The other thing I want to point out to everyone is this book in my hand, because I would like you to find me when I have this book. This is the original Guests of Griffith Observatory book. It began on May 14, 1935. And so the first signatures are from the opening of the observatory. They've been collected ever since. You are all guests of Griffith Observatory, and so I would like to have all of your signatures in here, and over today and tomorrow, I'll be here with the book. Well, thanks for that. And now I have to figure out to go forward, I think. No, that's not it. Great. I can take direction. Griffith Observatory's recent $93 million renovation and expansion included the development, design, fabrication, installation of the first comprehensive and integrated and cohesive exhibit program since the observatory first opened in 1935. And in fact, more than 65 new and precedent-shattering exhibits have been introduced into the historic building and into the new underground expansion which we occupy now. There's, of course, a whole other level above us. That's just a view into the Gunther depths of space that you passed in. On the back wall, by the way, that image of a segment of the sky, including the core of the Virgo cluster, that is the big picture. That is the largest astronomical image in the world. You might want to take a closer look at it later. The exhibits, like all Griffith Observatory programming, are rooted in the mission of transforming visitors into observers of nature and the sky. And throughout, they rely on the physical impact of instruments, models, mechanisms, and monumental displays. Just as an example of this, this is a new instrument integrated into the architecture on the west side as you just go out the doors from the edge of space to the west. This is the Gottlieb Transit Corridor, and it is, in fact, a monumental instrument that works daily and over longer cycles of time. One of the things that's happening there, the disk of the sun, projected image of the sun, is falling on the meridian arc at local noon, and the sensors in the arc are then sending a signal up to the ecliptic chart that's up on the wall there that lights up where the sun is located, as well as the background stars that are invisible at that same time that all this event is going on. The line that you see in the transit corridor, this is nothing with eclipses, but it helps to provide some context. That line is a meridian line. I know that you've heard of the Greenwich Meridian. That is the Griffith Meridian. Well, the in this approach, exhibits create one-of-a-kind concrete experiences. They are not textbooks. Instead, they offer vivid reference points for better understanding of astronomical objects and processes. The main level historic building now approaches astronomy from the ground-based perspective that prevailed for most of astronomy's history, while the new Gunther Depths of Space underground expansion emphasizes the transformations of perspective that have occurred only recently since our entry into space. And since he's here, let me also acknowledge Dr. Jay Kasikoff, who was one of our scientific consultants through the process of curating and developing our plan. So thanks, Jay, and nice to have you back here again. The Hall of the Eye on the east side of the historic building, and the Hall of the Sky on the west, and the Keck, that's a small part of the area on the Hall of the Sky on the west, and the Keck Foundation Central Rotunda, all retain the observatory's original architectural grandeur, and they establish how the eye extracts information from the sky and how primary objects we see in the sky, the sun and the moon, modulate our experience of the sky from the surface of the earth. Well, leveraging from Platform Earth, the Hall of the Sky dedicates its six historic exhibit alcoves, and there are just two that you see in this view here. To the left, by the way, is the rotunda, and that's where the Celestat is operating live every day with a white light image of the sun, solar spectrum, and an H-alpha filter. For the moment, let me just concentrate on these six alcoves. The six historic alcoves then have these six fundamental phenomena, and they are all the things that everybody could reasonably in some way sense from the Earth's surface, in fact, often do, and as we know from our encounters with visitors, even though they see these things, most of the time have no clue as to why they occur, which is why, in fact, we spotlight them. Each of these, then, diurnal motion, the daily paths of the sun and stars, seasons, phases of the moon, tides and eclipses, all of them involve the interaction of the sun and moon and Earth, and all of these are, of course, readily seen, but the mechanisms that drive them are not well understood by most people. So to demonstrate these effects and how they occur, most of the alcoves combine the action of a dynamic three-dimensional model with a coordinated animation that shows what's changing. And then there's supplemental support information in excessively simple diagrams, illustrative photographs, and rigorously distilled text. And it's all included then on conventional wavesides. And in each case, the information was prioritized to support a primary message. And of course, the point of all of this is that I want to present to you today one example of these alcoves that's relevant, of course, for this program, and that is the eclipses alcove, which is, of course, at the center of this particular image. Well, our original conception and our consequent development and design for these Hall of the Sky alcove exhibits were, of course, constrained by limited, tightly defined space that each would have to occupy, as well as on our priority on three-dimensional operating models. The specific topics that we spotlighted were really shaped by 70 years of questions that our visitors directed most often to our museum guides, but they all address also the primary consequences of the astronomical circumstances that are established by the relative motions of the Earth and the Moon and the Sun. Well, use of demonstration models does have archaic roots. And let me jump ahead. That's certainly part of our archaic roots. But medieval accounts detail an astronomical dimension of the Takhtis and Takht-e Suleiman in western Iran, now obviously a ruin. But this Sassanid Persian monument probably dates from the 3rd century A.D. And according to one source from the 10th century, it had, quote, huge, movable curtains through which they showed movements of heavenly bodies. The 12 signs and the 7 movables were all also demonstrated. They showed the moon and the sign which had set. Some stars stayed on, some passed by. You saw before your eyes the phenomena of the sky. The movements of the planets, the sun, and the moon were vividly shown across the sky. And you can sense at even this very early period, the attempt to model the sky mechanically was established in a variety of places, of course, including here. The gradual acceptance of Copernican theory prompted the fabrication of heliocentric models of the solar system. George Graham, an English instrument maker, invented the first orrery in the early 18th century. John Rowley's copy for the fourth Earl of Orrery, which displayed only the sun and the earth and the moon, led to the use of the Earl's name for this kind of a device, an orrery, obviously. And the point of these is that they have the potential for mimicking the configuration of eclipses as well as other simple celestial motions, and so demonstrating to an average person what exactly is going on. And in a sense, the water clock-driven armillary sphere developed by the Chinese astronomer Zhang Heng during the Eastern Han Dynasty in the 2nd century A.D. is also part of this tradition. This is not that instrument. Zhang Heng's instruments are long gone, but this is instrument, actually 14th century replica from the 12th century, but an instrument that represents an improvement but not a dramatic change from what was going on 1,000 years earlier. In any case, the earlier instrument simulated the sky and was designed to track the seven luminaries, the sun, moon, and the five planets visible to the unaided eye, seasonally significant events and times of dawn and dusk. And so we have taken our cue from Zhang Heng in Griffith Observatory's Hall of the Sky and extended the reach of his celestial modeling to the phases of the moon and tides and eclipses and so on. And when we were formulating the design requirements for the alcoves exhibits in the 2000 years, our exhibit team adopted six fundamental principles of design. The exhibit should explain fundamental astronomical concepts that are derived from direct experience of the sky. Number two, the exhibit should prompt, through an observational experience, a revelation of understanding. Three, whenever possible, the visitor should be able to enter the alcove to be immersed in the working environment of the model. Number four, the three-dimensional working models are preferable to still images or flat video. Number five, the visitor should be able to understand the exhibit without the help of an interpreter. And number six, the exhibit should make the most familiar phenomenon its primary theme and only introduce unexpected astronomical examples as secondary topics, if at all. Well, having already then determined one alcove would be committed to eclipses, we had to resound how to prioritize and then present the concepts and the observations involved in eclipses, and in particular, the development of a physical model that would demonstrate eclipse processes turned out to be especially challenging. A variety of messages for an eclipse exhibit can be imagined, including types of eclipses, eclipse geometry, observing eclipses, eclipse phenomena, historical understanding of eclipses, scientific use of eclipses, the cultural impact of eclipses, and eclipse prediction. Eclipses, of course, are anomalies in the rhythm of the sky, and they are treated as unusual events and special occasions by media, astronomers, and eclipse chasers. And so it's very easy to get involved with the exotica of this, whereas the regular audience may not, in fact, have the basics. In several sessions of discussion and analysis, the Griffith Observatory exhibit design team worked to identify fundamental questions. What fundamental questions should the exhibit really address? Doesn't seem like that's such a hard task, but it actually, especially with the committee, turns out to be harder than you'd imagine. Well, that question was eventually established, and it's really very simple. Why do solar and lunar eclipses occur? And by the end of September 2001, the team had determined the eclipse exhibit should demonstrate how the sun and moon align to cause solar and lunar eclipses and what we see when one happens. The average visitor's attention should be directed to eclipse periodicity and infrequency. we make a big deal about these eclipses, and the average visitor then should get a chance to understand why the big deal. Geometry, of course, shows the configurations that are required for eclipses. You know them well, total solar eclipse or a total lunar eclipse, very simple diagrams. But the diagrams of eclipse geometry don't really usually demonstrate how restrained eclipse geometry is. And showing in a physical model how the behavior of the Sun, Moon, and Earth conspire to eclipses imposed unusual challenges, even, I suspect, greater than what you can do on the drawing board. Further analysis outlined the character of the model. A bright sun, a glowing globe with an opening for a directed beam of light, would be suspended from the ceiling, a domed canopy, at the center of the alcove. And moving models of the Earth and the Moon should simulate the Earth's revolution around the Sun and the Moon's revolution around the Earth. Each would move at roughly the proper relative rate, and the Moon's orbit would be inclined to the Earth's orbit, and that means the Moon would only line up with the Earth and the Sun, of course, when it occupies a node, one of those two spots on its path across the path of the Earth around the Sun. Well, with this arrangement, it would be possible to see every new and full moon as the model operated, and it would also be possible to see an eclipse does not happen at every new and full moon. Again, an obvious point for all of you, but a fundamental question that visitors are regularly asking once they understand the general configuration of an eclipse and then understand the orbit of the moon around the Earth, and making sense out of those two things turns out to take a little effort. Well, the dimensions of the alcove and the model's height above the visitor ordain the size of the models. Both have to be large enough to see, and for plausibility, the Earth has to have a diameter four times larger than the moon. In practice, the Earth model diameter is 6 inches, and the moon model's diameter is 1.5 inches. And of course, in these models, like in any model, it is impossible to scale everything correctly, size or distance or timing. In fact, if you scaled everything correctly, you would actually have the real Earth, Moon, and Sun, and then you would have to have it. So the model has to operate quickly enough to keep the visitor attentive. This means the shadowing in any modeled eclipse will be very brief, and so it has to be conspicuous. If it's going to happen fast, you really have to be able to notice it. And in a small room, of course, it is not mechanically possible to scale correctly with sufficient visual impact the distance between the Earth and the Moon to their size, the timing and the duration of the eclipses, or the size of eclipse shadows. None of that, in fact, is practically possible at all. With models of a practical size, the moon's inclination, in fact, has to be exaggerated substantially. Well, we in fact discovered there's a very good reason, then, why large physical models demonstrating how eclipses happen have not been designed, fabricated, and installed in museums. Eclipses, for the most part, are the products of long, narrow shadows and small angular variations. And to be eye-catching, a model that generates and accurately scales eclipses would have to be prohibitively large. If the model is small, an accurate visual experience is certainly elusive. It's actually invisible. And so it fails to command visitor attention. So the model can show the general configuration of Earth and Moon and Sun in eclipse and demonstrate why eclipses don't occur at every new and full moon. And here, for example, with the Earth, Moon, and Sun, you have a new moon situation with no eclipse. And there, a little bit later in the cycle, Sun, Earth, and Moon for a full moon, and again, no eclipse. So you can get the inside and outside positions there and see how those correspond to the phases of the moon easily enough. Well, also, planning the exhibit, we considered the incorporation of additional topics, including previews of upcoming and solar lunar eclipses anecdotally, eclipse human interest tales, the gradual recession of the moon, the end of eclipses as we know them, images of eclipses on other planets, a video simulation of an eclipse of the sun from the moon, and eclipsing binary stars. There were all kinds of ancillary topics, and they all failed to make the final cut. Over the next 8 months, none of the specifications changed, but when the exhibit designer, C&G Partners in Manhattan, presented its interpretation of the design principles, the exhibit design team responded and refined the objectives of the exhibit. The primary theme remained unchanged. The exhibit would demonstrate how the sun and moon align to cause solar and lunar eclipses and would show what we see when one happens. There would be seven learning points, in fact, articulated. Number one, and again, these are so painfully obvious, I know, to you, but it is to illustrate how exhibit design proceeds. Eclipses happen when the sun, earth, and moon align. Number two, eclipses do not happen every month because the inclination of the moon's orbit puts the moon out of line most of the time. Nonetheless, eclipses happen at repeatable and predictable intervals. Eclipses of the sun happen when the moon moves in front of the sun, and they can be seen in only a restricted zone on the Earth. And eclipses of the moon happen when the moon moves into the shadow of the Earth, and they can be seen from about half of the Earth. Eclipses, especially solar eclipses, are visually dramatic events. So these, then, were the distilled points that the exhibit had to get across to people. By this time, it was also confirmed a panel would interpret the overhead model, especially the timing of eclipses. A video display would show the changing appearance of the sun in a total solar eclipse and the changing appearance of the moon in a total lunar eclipse. And a small changing video screen on a wayside would let visitors preview upcoming solar and lunar eclipses with computer simulations. Constraints on the overhead model also had become more clear. This arrangement of the model should produce four to six solar and lunar eclipses during every year or circuit of the model Earth around the Sun. And the Moon model, of course, had to circle the Earth model 12 to 13 times during one revolution of the Earth model. In current operation, the model Earth orbits the Sun model every 72 seconds. The Moon orbits the Earth in 6. So when the Moon's shadow crosses the Earth model, it takes less than a second to do it. And the exaggerated inclination of the Moon's orbit in order to make that event happen is actually 23.5 degrees. So the whole idea of the model is to have people watch and see full moon, new moon, full moon, new moon, no eclipse, no eclipse, no eclipse, no eclipse, ah, there's an eclipse. And it's a constrained situation, and then it passes. The model operates continuously, and the video screen independently illustrates a progressive change in the appearance of the sun in a total solar eclipse and in the moon in a total lunar eclipse. But it has to operate independently of the model, unlike the other alcoves where they're all synchronized. The action here is just too fast. It's kind of like an eclipse. Primary graphic on the back wall illustrates and specifies all of the orbital and shadow geometry. The complexities of the geometry have been simplified to make the configuration of eclipses transparent in the short time most people dedicate to an exhibit element. You typically have about a minute, people. Maybe three, depending. This is not attention deficit disorder. People, they're watching stuff happen, and they got a whole place to go through, and it's whatever catches their fancy at the moment. So every message has to be with bullet-like precision and compression. The video animation simulates a total solar eclipse, and obviously it's not the real thing, but you get the impression, and then a lunar eclipse as well for people. And then the waysides are the supplemental information. They reiterate with simple diagrams the relationship between the sun and the moon and the earth in a solar eclipse and a lunar eclipse, along with photographs that document how the total eclipse sun and moon look to us with simple and brief explanatory text. So you can see, obviously, the wayside for solar eclipses and lunar eclipses. And then the video wayside, and this is up and operating now, and it is profiling, of course, the upcoming total lunar eclipse on the 28th of August, so people can get a chance to see just how that proceeds just by walking up there and looking at it. Well, very quickly, in the credits department, Mark Klein, who's now the deputy director of Griffin Observatory, managed the entire exhibit program while working for Friends of the Observatory, our partner in this whole process. The curatorial team included astronomers and teachers from a variety of local institutions, as well as essential members of the Observatory. Observatory's programming and production staff. C&G Partners designed the exhibits and Malfi fabricated them. Carolyn Collins Peterson developed a voice of the observatory style and wrote all of the captioning and in the building. MAD Systems, you can imagine how much fun they're to work with. MAD Systems constructed the model, and RBH Multimedia assembled the animated Eclipse videos. There's an abiding temptation to turn exhibits into books and to attempt to say everything that could be said about the showcase subject. The overwhelming majority of visitors, however, do not come to read, but they come to experience. And the average visitor, as I said, spends an astonishingly short time in any one place. A minute really is extraordinary. The fundamentals have to be obvious and almost instantaneously accessed. And to be inviting, supporting information has to be compressed into essentials and presented in simple, direct language. That means common words, short sentences, and explicit purpose. The space available for exposition is as limited as the time the visitor is prepared to dedicate. So proportion and layout profoundly affect the visitor's willingness to commit time to text. A unified and a consistent scheme of presentation establishes a pattern of experience throughout the building. And if you move throughout this building, you will see that unified style. Repetition cultivates a sense of familiarity and then induces in the visitor an expectation that makes all interpretive panels more accessible. All of these considerations, therefore, place the limit of 125 to 150 words on each interpretive panel. That was as many words as you had. Didn't matter what the topic was, it had to fit there. Quite interestingly, quite amazingly, you can always do it. While it might seem dauntingly little, you actually can deliver the most important information. It simply forces the writer to adopt an effective and a satisfying discipline. The exhibits, like every other element at Griffith Observatory, are really not designed to fulfill curriculum standards, although they support them. Furthermore, they do not offer menus on computer screens, an approach that is all too fashionably now promoted as interactive. Rather, the exhibits and all the rest of Griffith Observatory's astronomical experiences prompt the visitor to go do the next thing, to go read a book, or peruse a magazine, or access the web, or watch a documentary, or take a course, or go to a museum, or hear a lecture, or ask one of our museum guys a question, or of course observe the sky, or even go see an eclipse. Eclipses are notoriously infrequent and short, but when time and distance and size are scaled and distorted in a model that illustrates what a shadow must do in eclipse, the elusive nature of eclipses becomes evident to the visitor. And at Griffith Observatory, the result is a simple and truly interactive exhibit that requires the visitor to observe and then understand. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Ed. Anybody have any questions for Dr. Krupp? Here we have one from Daniel.
Do you do any studies on how these people actually increase their understanding while having seen this exhibit or the photo?
Let's see, we still got that. Daniel asked a very good question, which is, it's nice to posture as I do, but do I actually know this is true? And actually, from a disciplined point of view, the answer is absolutely not. The task of assessing educational assimilation is a very large one, and one that many people actually engage in. But Griffith Observatory, I must confess, is actually far too occupied with simply moving visitors through. So our response to that is really strictly anecdotal. But it's 70 years, actually a little more now, of anecdotes. And you're out on the floor with people, and you have a staff that has worked with people over decades. And so you accumulate information from people. Now, can we turn that into real statistics and say, for now we know that people, this percentage of folks actually now understand eclipse? Absolutely not. But what I can tell you is I walk the floor of Griffith Observatory, I stop, I talk to people, and anecdotally you get the pleasure of hearing over and over again people say, oh, I got that, or look at that, or you watch people from the side just what you do, what they do. So the real answer to your question is, nope, we don't undertake serious study except when NASA grants require us to.
philosophy or approach that takes into account the fact that you have visitors who are fifth graders and visitors who are college graduates. How do you end it?
I guess everybody can hear that, which is how do you aim, since you have this incredible span of people coming here, which is the whole point. I would like to be glib and say, nah, you know, I just, I know what I think is fun, and to some extent that's true. To some extent, much of what we do is guided by that sense of what is it that excites me, and you look to that in presentation of planetarium shows as well as on the floor, and it emerges over time. And it's a very simple thing in a sense. It's audience response. It's an anecdotal response here, but I'll tell you, when you give a show in a planetarium, if you're going dead, you know it fast, and you got to fix it fast. You can't afford to lose the audience, and so you learn how, in fact, to reach most people. But let me be a little bit more formal and say, yeah, we gave a lot of thought to that. We really did, and especially in terms of all of the writing that you'll find throughout here, that is very specifically written to a grade standard reading level. It's shockingly low if you hear it, so I'm not going to tell you what it is. But the fact is that even though it's shockingly low, it turns out to be very pleasant because adults and kids often like the same thing. And so I don't think it's that hard to hit that audience. But you have to pay attention to the audience. You have to be audience-oriented.
Thank you very much. And